Hello and welcome to the Tech Disruptors podcast. Here we talk with CEOs and management teams about their views on tech disruption and how it is driving their decision making and strategy. My name is Sunil Rajgopal and I am a software analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, the in-house equity research arm of Bloomberg LP. We are happy to welcome Naveen Rao, head of AI at Databricks, a company that is reshaping the enterprise data management and intelligence space through its cloud-centric data lakehouse platform. Naveen, thank you for coming on to our podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
Great. Naveen, we certainly have a lot to unpack on Databricks and Mosaic ML and the fast-changing AI space. But before that, I want to prick your brains on this book that I am reading by Jeff Hawkins called A Thousand Brains, which talks about the intricacies of human brain and how it works. And given your background in neuroscience, I would love to hear your thoughts on where we are in this journey of equipping machines with human intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I think a lot of the systems we are building today actually do have some inspiration in what we've learned from brains. You know, my advisor used to always tell me that the way we understand brains is always a metaphor of technology, and then technology kind of feeds off our understanding of brains to build new capabilities. You know, we used to think of brains as a switchboard at one point, then brains became a CPU, then brains became something else. You know, it's always these metaphors that go forward. So we're always trying to understand complex systems through these metaphors that we have a good grounding on. So we're still pretty far away, in my view, from what actual brains can do. Brains are very efficient in their computation. All of what we are, everything that encompasses the processing that makes us who we are, is in 20 watts of energy in our brain. That's extremely efficient. I mean, even if you argued there's a whole bunch of priors that have been baked in from evolution, from our genes and all of that, it's still incredible to think that our entire brain runs on 20 watts of energy. So I think just from a pure efficiency standpoint, we're still very far away. But even from a capability standpoint, I think we're getting to a point where we can actually start to see a future where machines can become intelligent. And today we've moved from systems that can actually discover useful feature sets for explaining data, which is what we were doing in kind of neural networks 1.0, before generative AI took off. And now with generative AI, we can actually build systems that can do hypothesis generation. And so that's one big part of intelligence. What brains tend to do and what animals tend to do is actually generate hypotheses based on priors, generate actions on those hypotheses, execute those actions, observe the consequences in the world, and then update their model of hypothesis generation. That whole action, sensory action loop is actually still not represented yet in generative AI. So we are getting closer, but we're still a ways away.
It's interesting that you mentioned human brain runs on 20 watts of energy. So how does this compare versus NVIDIA's H100, H200, and the new one, the Blackwell, just for a comparison?
Yeah, I mean, the Blackwell runs, one chip is 1,000 watts. So that's just one chip. When we're running inference, like basically when we put one of these large language models into deployment, we may be running on 8 chips. So, that's just running inference. And these models are nowhere close to what a human brain can do. And that doesn't really encompass learning. When the models are learning, they're running on thousands of chips, which are, millions of watts. So we're many orders of magnitude away just from a sheer efficiency standpoint of computation. But then even from a capability standpoint, backpropagation is probably not how the brain works. The brain actually does a lot of local computation and sort of local tight intercommunication with of information versus a lot more of a global kind of interconnect strategy, which is what we do today with large scale deep learning or large language models.
That's interesting. And going back to your journey in the technology world, which I believe predates the internet boom, and you have seen all the boom and bust cycles since 1996. How do you see the current AI hype cycle, and why do you think or don't think it's different from the previous cycles?
Yeah, you're dating me now, but I think there's a lot of similarity in some ways. I mean, it was very clear that there was some sort of secular shift. Something was going to change in a big way when we could deliver content and information seamlessly to people from almost point to point over the internet. That really changed. We knew it was going to change the way we delivered media. We knew it was going to change the way we delivered shopping experiences. There's also a lot of profound things beneath that it changed. I mean, being able to communicate with each other in real time and access to all the world's information, all of these kinds of things. So we knew that one shift was going to create a big paradigm shift in the way humans acted. The business models were not sorted out. So there was a lot of excitement around the internet and anything that was connected to the internet. And a lot of that just died away because they didn't think about a new business model that encompasses this new, delivery mechanisms and the economics therein. Or it was just like taking something that was an existing model and putting it on the internet. And, everybody called themselves an internet company. It was very similar to what I see today, where AI is just like, it's like a panacea, be all end all. It's like, hang on, you actually have to rethink how this is going to make money. So while I agree on one hand, it's very similar because the hype and the recognition of a paradigm shift, I think, and the fact that there's a lot of companies that are going to go bust, I think it's slightly different in the way it's manifesting, right? This is a new set of capabilities. It's not necessarily a connectivity strategy. It's like how we'll interact with machines, what machines can do in our lives. And so I think that aspect of it's going to make it, it's going to take a bit longer for some of these transitions to happen. I mean, AI has been kind of an ongoing thing for 10 years now. And it takes a while to actually start changing our experiences of using machines because machines work pretty well. We have point and click devices and keyboards and all that stuff that work very well. So it takes a long time to kind of upend that with a new paradigm, but it is going to happen. And I think that recognition is important. So I think hype is how we make sense of the world and how we actually affect some of these changes. So I actually don't see it as a bad thing. It's just a natural consequence of everyone recognizing that, oh my God, something has changed.
I certainly agree with you that we are entering this new phase of competition. And with AI, we will certainly see a lot of changes in every industry probably. But maybe coming back to maybe Databricks, but before Databricks, I thought it could be interesting to go through your background. I know you have co-founded two companies before coming on to Databricks. Can you talk us through on that journey and how Mosaic ML came about and what motivated you to join hands with Databricks?
Yeah, I mean, starting companies is, it's a emotional roller coaster, and just, it's a lot of work. And so you have to be very, I think you have to be just very thoughtful about what area you're going to go into. It's not something you can play in as a tourist. You're either completely in or you fail. That's it. And so picking an area to go after, you have to have some kind of unfair advantage. You have to have some kind of insight that most people haven't yet had. And I think timing is extremely important. I would argue actually timing is as important, if not more important, than the vision of what the future looks like. I mean, I know a lot of people, a lot of entrepreneurs feel that vision is the thing that you need to have. And you have, this great vision to go make a pitch. It's like, yeah, that's fine. You have to have that, but you also need to be able to time it right. So it's such that the markets will actually take these things up and you can actually build a product you can sell. And also that technology is there at the right economics to actually sell something and make money. all of this goes together in building a product strategy that will actually be successful. So when we started Mosaic, we recognized, this is well before ChatGPT, but we recognized large models and model training, deployments, all the capabilities around building and maintaining models was both very important. So many organizations need these capabilities, need to be able to customize models on their data and express the value of their data through models. But at the same time, it was also very difficult and expensive. You know, at that time, there was, you know, rumors that GPT-3 costs something like, you know, $10 million to train. That sounded like just this ridiculous number that no one could go after, and it was just going to get worse. And we said, well, can we actually, one, make it easier for companies to be able to train models at scale, like on 1,000 GPUs? Can we do that through clever software strategies and abstractions? And then two, can we actually reduce the intrinsic cost of training a model by very clever algorithmic tricks and innovations? And we started with the second question first, because that's kind of the more deep technology problem. And I reached out to a guy named Jonathan Frankel, who is now the chief scientist of Mosaic and now of this group inside of Databricks, about his paper, The Lottery Ticket Hypothesis. This laid out a framework for how to think about, you know, where some of the fat is within training and how neural networks learn. So I reached out to him and his advisor, Mike Carbon, who is actually, he was an MIT professor who's actually with us full time right now. So we just got to talking over the summer. And then I pulled in my other co-founder, Hanlin Tang. And, you know, we came to the conclusion that we could not only find a lot of efficiency by doing better with algorithms, but it wasn't going to be a 20 or 30% thing. It was going to be like a 10x, 20x kind of improvement. And so that's when we decided to start the company and get it off the ground at the beginning of 2021, January 2021. And, you know, we had to go through all the building phases of prototyping products, talking with people, you know, getting it to a point where we could actually sell it. And then things kind of took off after ChatGPT. Everybody wanted to be able to build their custom models. And we were able to build amazing models using our own infrastructure and our own tooling. And we actually shared that with the world through the MPT series of open source models. And I think, you know, Databricks actually, interestingly, had lost a deal to us, or I think even two deals to us. And that's where we piqued their interest. And had a few conversations with Ali, and, you know, it was really clear that we could go faster together. And I think, you know, it's very hard in the enterprise space to actually build the sales motion and all the things that are required to make, to become successful in an enduring way, to become the trusted platform for enterprises. It takes a lot more than just technology. And, you know, I was convinced that we could actually bolt onto the sales process and the sales engine that Databricks had built over 10 years and to go faster and actually win that part of the enterprise. And, you know, beyond that, there was a lot of cultural alignment between the way we built the company at Mosaic and the way Databricks works. You know, it's founded by people who are from academia, who are PhDs, who believe in research and open source. And, you know, just culturally, just a really close alignment. So I felt this was actually going to be a really high chance of success, which is not always true with acquisitions. And, you know, so far it's proving out to be the right hypothesis. We're 8 months in and, you know, we're shipping a lot of amazing products right now.
Now, I certainly want to touch on a lot of things that you talked about, like the foundational models and the cost of running it or building them. But maybe before that, let's touch a little bit on the Databricks story. I don't think the company is any longer in a brick stage, right? You have reached $1.6 billion plus revenue run rate, and the company has substantially solidified its position in the data solutions world. Can you talk us through about the products and solutions that are in the market today, and how does that stack up with other competitors?
Yeah, I mean, what people don't realize is that when building a great foundation model or building a customized model for a business, it all starts with data. All of this technology is actually nothing without good data. If you have poor data going into a model, you'll have a poor model. So data engineering actually becomes front and center when you're building Gen AI solutions. And so what we have now is actually a true end-to-end platform where companies can ingest data about their business. You know, they put all their sales data, they put all their supply chain data, all those kinds of things. We have all the standard tools around, you know, business intelligence and dashboarding that people can build. And then now we're layering on all of these generative AI capabilities that allow you to express the value of that data in new ways. So you can take data that lives inside of Databricks, inside of Delta and Unity Catalog and all the classic products, and actually use that for pre-training a model using our tools or fine-tuning an existing model. Then once you have this artifact, customized model, you can actually put that into deployment and run inference with us. Okay, that sounds great. But then beyond that is actually all about how do I continuously improve it? So we have all the infrastructure in place to deploy that model, allow users to provide feedback, incorporate that feedback into a new data set we call a supervised fine-tuning data set, and then improve the model further. Rinse and repeat, keep doing this kind of a thing. So it starts with data, it starts with finding ways to express the value of that data through a model, and then continuous improvement of that model. So we have just model serving, fine tuning of open source models, also state of the art open source models, then pre-training of models from scratch, also things like RAG, which is retrieval augmented generation, vector databases, embedding models, the whole shebang. So we're kind of a one-stop shop for companies to be able to build generative AI solutions that are custom for their business.
Now, it seems that you have a wide field of competitors. And one interesting thing that stands out is, of course, Snowflake is one big player in the data management space, and they did acquire a company called Neeva. Now, what I'm wondering is, was there any kind of a relationship between, say, Snowflake acquiring Neeva and then Databricks acquiring Mosaic ML? What led to what?
I don't think there was a direct relationship. I mean, we know the Neeva guys pretty well. We were talking with them, as when we were independent companies. Neeva is much more of an enterprise search company. They're much less of a Gen AI infrastructure company. That's what we did at Mosaic. So we were actually trying to get Neeva as a customer. So I think it's a pretty different thing. I mean, honestly, like in the Gen AI space, we don't really look at Snowflake as a competitor at the moment. Obviously in the data platform space, yes, huge competitor. But we have a set of capabilities that I think are pretty differentiated from anyone. I mean, we can build state-of-the-art foundation models. That's something that only very few people can do. And we can leverage our data tools to build better foundation models than others. And just a little hint of some things to come very soon, maybe by the time this podcast is aired, you'll see an expression of that, a new set of models that are at the state of the art and even beyond every other open source model out there. We're going to demonstrate the power of our platform combined with Databricks.
How does the Databricks platform compare with the old champions, or maybe I should call incumbents like Oracle, which is certainly making a lot of investments in the data space and also boosting its AI push? So how are you looking at Oracle in this space now?
I mean, Oracle is interesting because Oracle, like the database side of the company, honestly, we don't really interact with much. I mean, that's, you know, their bread and butter is on-prem and, you know, all of the supply chain stuff that they do with companies. That's a very different area from where we interact. We're all cloud. Like Databricks is all cloud. And on the Gen AI side, you know, Oracle is actually a cloud as well. So OCI, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, is a cloud that we use extensively. We've partnered with them multiple times. on delivering solutions to customers. And we've written blogs about this. So we work with Oracle Cloud quite a lot. And so I think Oracle Cloud has built a fantastic infrastructure for GPUs. We run our tools seamlessly on top of Oracle Cloud. So we work with Oracle quite a lot on that regard. But in terms of the legacy database business, it's not something we really interact a whole lot with.
On the platform deployment options, you obviously pointed out it's a cloud-led solution that you have at Databricks. And there are two things that stand out from a underlying technology perspective, that is from a genesis of Databricks has stemmed from Apache Spark. And then now Apache Iceberg is making a lot of headlines, especially with the data lakehouse solutions becoming more robust. High velocity data querying and analytics has become much more easier. And it is also somewhat reducing the volumes that goes into data warehouses, which are relatively more expensive to use. So how are you thinking through about this latest developments with regarding to Apache Iceberg, and what does it lead to the overall data management space?
I mean, there are much better people at the company to talk about, you know, this, how this space evolves. But I think, you know, we are building towards standards that enable us to interoperate with many other tools out there. You know, these format wars of what kind of metadata gives the best experience and best capabilities are going to be continuing to go forward. But we're building tools to enable us to work in a world where customers have multiple types of lakehouses and data warehouses, and they can use our tools on top of all of that. So like Unity Catalog, our governance structure, actually is quite unique in that it can provide governance, lineage, access control on top of things within our data warehouse. It also applies to Gen AI, but we can even connect that to other data warehouses. So it becomes a centralized place that allows customers to have a single view of these things, even across other solutions. But when it comes to like generative AI, we want to make sure that our tools, our capabilities can interoperate with all the other things that customers have. So pulling in data from multiple sources, formatting it, that's something that's kind of bread and butter to the Databricks platform. And then once we have things put into the right formats, you can leverage all the wonderful tools that we're building for building customized Gen AI.
Staying on the AI theme, again, I'm trying to also get the best out of your neuroscience background. Maybe let's talk a little bit about neuromorphic computing. What does it mean for a common person?
Yeah, so neuromorphic is a field of research, really, around essentially biomimicry. Can I take our understanding of how brains are structured and how they process information and try to mimic that in a synthetic system? You know, as I said at the beginning, our brains are vastly more efficient than existing computers. And, you know, they have these capabilities that they're vastly better than existing AI solutions. So it only kind of makes sense to say, well, let's try to copy as much as we can and see if we can build something that's, you know, equivalent. What's happened through this field, though, has been about trying to mimic the neuron at a biophysical level, which that's where Carver Mead, who was the sort of father of this field, he was a professor at Caltech. He kind of came up with this concept of mimicking the biophysics in a circuit. And then you can string these things together and potentially get something that's like a brain. The problem is that intelligence is not just about how the neuron works. It's about how groups of neurons work together, how they work together stably to actually create learning. And that's not so simple. That hasn't actually, you don't see this kind of capability to simply emerge because you've built a bunch of elements that mimic the biophysics of a brain. So I think the problem is like the brain operates at multiple levels. The biophysics of neurons are part of it. And maybe that's part of the efficiency, but that is not enough to create a system that actually works stably and can learn. So systems that have worked really well have been more of these deep learning systems, which use a more well-grounded mathematical approach called backpropagation. And that seems to be working very well. I mean, I don't think it's the be-all end-all. I think we do have to engineer better solutions. But today that works really well. I can map it really nicely to existing systems, like GPU, CPU-based systems. And I can actually make a thing that works. And so I think this has been the issue with neuromorphic is that it's not quite there yet. It's almost like starting too low level and approaching the efficiency problem at the lowest end without actually contemplating how it's going to work in terms of the learning problem at a higher scale.
Now, coming to the second part of my question, talking about these foundational models and especially what you built at Mosaic ML, I think one thing that you always flagged in terms of your marketing materials was the cost of training these models is comparatively much lower than on the other platforms. Can you talk us through about how did you come about this comparison, or how does the Mosaic ML platform stack up in terms of cost comparison versus others?
I mean, as far as I know, we are quite a bit better than anybody else out there in terms of compute efficiency, in terms of training a model to completion in the lowest number of dollars. We spend a lot of time optimizing things, making the best usage of the hardware that's out there, and pushing the forefront on the newest features. Actually, just today, or was it yesterday, we published a blog on using the new floating point 8-bit formats from NVIDIA. And doing it, not just using it, that's easy. Calling a library and making it work is one thing, but actually making it work to train the model end to end and doing it at scale across, like, say, 1,000 GPUs. That's where these things get complicated, and that's where everybody else's solutions fall down. And we do this because we want to continue to deliver better economics on an exponential scale. So what I mean by that is a model that you could build today that costs X dollars and has Y, score on some evaluation metric will cost X divided by $4 in a year and hit that same eval metric. We see this as almost a law where we see 4X cost savings every year. About 20 or 30% of that comes from hardware, but the rest come from software and algorithmic optimizations. And this is not running out anytime soon. We're continuously seeing this. So if you imagine, like, something that costs $100 million today, in a year will be $25 million. In a year after that will be $6 million. So this starts becoming very accessible to a very large group of people very fast. 4X per year is a huge exponent. Just for most of the listeners who aren't familiar, people may have heard of Moore's Law. Moore's Law is 2X cost savings every 2 years. It's about 40% per year. So this is a much faster rate of improvement than we've ever seen in any other area. And we're doing it through very clever optimization techniques of that we bake into the algorithms and software optimizations, as well as using the latest stuff from the hardware makers.
I mean, NVIDIA's recent event is a good example on how the computing powers are growing. And of course, GPU demand appears to be unrelenting. Can you talk about what underlying infrastructure you are using to build your solutions at Databricks? And do you have the requisite capacity in terms of compute power to ramp up your offerings?
Yeah, so we work on top of all the major clouds. So, AWS, Azure, GCP, and Oracle Cloud, as well as, some smaller GPU providers. So we run primarily on NVIDIA today. We are constantly investigating new hardware platforms like AMD, Intel, AWS Trainium and Inferentia, Google TPU. We're looking at all the new hardware out there and basically trying to get the same or try to beat trying to lower the price of delivery of capabilities to our customers. That's our value prop, is that we find the best possible hardware to run their solutions. And we abstract away the complexity of running on different kinds of hardware to make it easy for our customers. So, you know, we do absolutely have capacity. We can bring on new customers, and we do it through our relationships with these cloud providers. We ourselves do not stand up hardware. We are a multi-cloud software platform that runs on top of all the major clouds.
Can you talk about the kind of applications that your customers are building today, and how has joining hands with Databricks enhanced that journey?
Yeah, I mean, we have all kinds of different customers, from regulated industries like finance and healthcare to tech companies, you know, like Replit and several others, and you know, airline companies like JetBlue, you know, digital native companies, and fintech like Block. These are all companies that are leveraging Gen AI in different ways. So some of them are doing things like automating internal processes, so making it easier for employees to get information and do their jobs faster, doing some kind of optimization, maybe around supply chain or some other process within the company. And then some of these companies are using it externally for better assisting their customers, like chatbots for support. That actually is a huge offload from an operational standpoint, but also improves the customer experience. Then some of them are actually driving whole new experiences, like the Replit folks we've talked about several times. But you know, Replit is a startup that has a shared IDE, like a programming environment, across multiple users. And they basically are using Gen AI to better autocomplete code, suggest different kind of code snippets, basically make people more productive. We're seeing companies do things like code maintenance and code conversions using Gen AI. These all become actually very custom and bespoke deployments, because each one of these customers has their own data sets that have their own characteristics, and they have their own business outcomes that they care about. So they very much require a platform that allows them to take their data, customize the models, you know, build something that's a capability that they need, and then go and deploy that against that capability.
Just curious though, on the application side of things, is there any kind of a competition between the likes of Databricks like yours and companies like Palantir and C3 AI?
I mean, Palantir and C3 AI largely bring human power to these kinds of problems. I mean, they probably bring some software expertise as well, but for the most part, they're bringing human power, which is important. And solving these problems generally involves some kind of, you know, orchestration of tools, you know, writing some code to stitch these things together. People need that. So that's not really our business. We're a software tools provider. We bring the capabilities to train, fine tune, and serve models, as well as, you know, bring in things like vector databases to do RAG. So we have those software components, and we get paid for usage of those components. In fact, we're happy to work with companies like, you know, Palantir or the like to help service end customers. They can bring in our tools, our components, and they can apply their expertise and their domain expertise for particular customer segments. That's not what we do. So we don't see them as real competitors per se. They're more, you know, there's going to be some things they offer that are probably competitive. We all do that. But we are a technology provider at the end of the day.
I mean, it's been, 2 years since Databricks and Mosaic ML joined hands, or probably what? Probably it's...
No, it's only been eight months.
Okay, eight months. So how is the integration progressing, and what is the future path look like in terms of your products?
Yeah, so I mean, the integration's been going really well. I think I don't think you could have done it much better than what we have, and that's because, you know, we had a very strong cultural fit, a lot of mutual respect between the teams, and you know, just a really good rapport with, you know, the leadership of Mosaic and Databricks. And so, you know, the team is actually all the AI resources are under me now. And we're doing that so we can drive some unification of our experiences and our tools across traditional AI and Gen AI. Because really, Gen AI is kind of a bigger version of traditional AI. So the products we're building are tighter integrations with the Databricks experience. So things like SSO and authentication is actually quite hard. You need to actually integrate our services into the authentication of Databricks, and then Databricks customers get access to it. So today, if you're a Databricks customer, you sign on and you'll actually see a whole generative AI panel where people can play with the latest open source models. Things like fine tuning are already integrated, but we're in private previews, like a gated preview with some customers. That's going to get GA'd over the next couple of months. Then full pre-training. This is actually pretty interesting. Being able to spin up thousands of GPUs and actually do this stuff in a serverless way is what we're going to be bringing to the market, you know, over the next couple of months. And this is all with data that lives inside of Databricks's data stores like Delta and Unity Catalog. And we have governance and access control, lineage, all of that stuff tracked within Databricks. So I think that's actually something that nobody has, is that, you know, if you want to build a model off of data that lives in Databricks and you want to have that model inherit the attributes of that data. Like some of that data might be sensitive. Only certain users might be able to see it. So when you fine tune a model on that model now gets tracked with the same lineage infrastructure as the data did. So that's something that's quite nice. When you put that model into deployment, every time that API is hit, it'll actually be logged and it'll say, this is the user that hit the model. This is what they asked. This is what the model returned. And we can even integrate feedback into that. So if the model liked the output or they didn't like the output and they provided an alternative, you know, this is what the output should have been, we can log all of that. We can actually create data sets to improve the model over time. So that's this continuous improvement of the models for their purposes that companies are using them for is exactly what our vision is. We want to build custom AI, custom reasoning on your data. That's really the goal of this overall. So that's for the Gen AI solutions that our customers use. Databricks itself has experiences that customers of the data platform might want to use, and we're integrating Gen AI at all levels there. We're actually able to allow customers to query their data just in English, you know, pull up all the data of sales of widget X in EMEA from 2016 to 2019. You shouldn't have to write a SQL query. You should be able to do this in English. So we're building these sorts of experiences as well. And, you know, basically the whole platform is being transformed now into something that both uses Gen AI to increase the capabilities of the platform, as well as empowers our customers to have these capabilities to work off of their data and provide better experiences for their customers.
So that looks like an exciting pipeline of products to come.
Absolutely.
Just one big picture question I have before we move on to our final question. So what is the grand vision for Databricks, maybe looking out 5 to 10 years? And given that Databricks has done a lot of M&A activity in the last few years, so what does that path look like in the future?
Well, M&A is always strategic and is an important way to grow our capabilities. So, you know, I can't comment on that because we don't even know which companies would be impactful for us to acquire in a few years. So, yeah, I think, you know, we're going to look and see what the environment looks like and always try to bring the best into our fold. In terms of, you know, what the vision is, it's really, we want to be the singular platform where you can imagine you put all of your data becomes a context about a business. Really what's happened in the AI world is that we can now incorporate context into generation of output. That's really the big innovation with an LLM, a large language model, is I can say, hey, here's all the stuff that is context for your answer. Now I'm going to ask a question and give me an answer. That context is data. How can we use customers' data to provide novel insights over time? Like imagine a agent that sort of lives in your Databricks environment and is driving novel insights to you. It's like, hey, you know what? If you change the way you ordered your you know, widgets from a supplier by moving it from this date to that date, you'll actually save 10%. And that'll increase our gross margins by X. like these kinds of insights are things that humans typically do today by kind of poring over reports and looking at business intelligence. Can we start to automate that and actually build customized reasoning engines for each and every business out there to allow them to leverage their data in better ways?
Great. So Naveen, that brings us to the concluding section of our podcast that I call as final three. Your answers to these can be one-liners. So are you ready?
Sure.
All right. Number one, what are the three metrics or aspects any developer needs to remember when it comes to foundational models or LLMs?
Well, evaluation is extremely important. Making sure you define what success is. So defining that exam that says something is good or something is bad. If you can't do that, you don't have, you'll never actually be able to decide what is a better solution or what is a worse solution. Privacy and security is extremely important. Whenever you fine tune a model, if that's in somebody's fine tuning service, that model, those model weights actually encode some aspects about your data. So this is, if you don't get the weights of that data, you have lost control of your data. That's a very important aspect here. And then continuous improvement, always finding ways to make the model better. The model is not a static thing. It should be something that meets a minimum bar for success, like using these evaluation criteria. Then you put it into deployment and you gather telemetry continuously. When are users happy? When are they upset? When are you actually, you know, making doing better in terms of a business context, saving all of that information and using it to improve the model, and then, you know, put the new model into deployment.
Staying on to the theme of LLMs and foundational models, my second question here is, with the growing sizes of all these foundational models, I just read that probably Google has launched a new model with, 1 million parameters or something like that. And do
a
you
trillion,
think...
trillion, probably.
So do you think we have reached a peak in terms of all these models or size of the models and how things are going?
No, I don't think so. I mean, just for reference, the human brain has 86 billion neurons, each of which has on the order of, 1,000 to 10,000 parameters. So you're in the hundreds of trillions of parameters for a human brain. But I think the key is that just scaling parameters is not enough. That is what has hit somewhat of a wall. I mean, I wouldn't call it a wall per se, but it's a limiting factor. You can actually extract a lot more out of a smaller parameter model than previously thought. And there's techniques for doing that with data quality, with, continuing to train something. You can get a lot of a very high quality model with smaller number of parameters. And so we should always do that. But parameters are definitely an important part of what gives a model capabilities. And so right now we have scaled up on data, going to trillions and trillions of tokens, and scaled up on parameters. That's kind of, that paradigm is maybe not going to be sufficient to provide the newest breakthroughs in the future. And so that's where we really have to think about data quality, feedback, and making the model better over time.
Great. So my last question to conclude this section is, what is the next big thing to watch out in the AI or neuroscience space, which is your specialty, now that we are starting to implant chips into human brains? Where do we go from here?
Well, my PhD was actually on neural prosthetics. So my lab had actually done the first human, what we call intraparenchymal, so inside the brain implants in humans in 2004. So this is not new. Elon did not invent this. This was actually done well before. So I think that's still an ongoing science problem. There are lots of hard problems to solve there. But I think generative AI is giving us the one piece of intelligence, which is hypothesis generation. And I think robotics are an area that are going to start to become really rich and really viable in terms of use cases. I mean, robotics are important today in industrialization, right? When we talk about building things and automation, yeah, robotics are, but being able to get these things into the hands of many, many different use cases, automating small businesses, that sort of a thing. It's been tried for 10 years. I think we're going to be closer now, especially with generative AI and being able to generate hypotheses. There's still a lot of work in grounding the outputs of these models to reality. But once we solve some of these problems, I think robotics are right around the corner. So that's like something, my prediction in the next 5 years is that we're going to start to see much more generalized robotics reasoning engines that can really change the way we use robotics today and make things that are much more generalizable.
I would have loved to talk more about robotics and humanoids, but I think we have run up our time here. Naveen, this has been super helpful, and the insights you shared are incredibly valuable. Thank you very much for taking time for our podcast, and thank you for coming on to our show.